It's not just what's the probability the business flops, that 30% number, right? It's, okay, well, in that scenario of the business flopping, what are the other scenarios associated with that?
Building a company from nothing is freaking hard. Us entrepreneurs are expected to deal with unimaginable challenges and somehow keep a cool head through it all. This is The Art of Entrepreneurship, and I'm your host, Jackie Hermes. I grew my company, Excelity, from 0 to 7 figures with no partners and no funding. The Art of Entrepreneurship is a show where we cut through the BS and dig into what it actually takes to start and grow a company. If you give me your time, I promise it won't be wasted. Now let's get to work. Hello, and welcome back to The Art of Entrepreneurship. Today, we are talking about a tension that every company selling into an established industry has probably felt. Your customer says that they want to innovate and they've been talking about modernization for years, but when it actually comes time to change, everything goes slow. I have been there many times. Decisions happen by committee and they take forever. New ideas get picked apart and the way that things have always been done still carry a lot of weight. I'm talking about a lot of the older industries that some of us work in, that is like insurance, healthcare, education. This is a lot of the industries that my company, Excelity, works in. I think in these situations, it can be really easy to assume that it's just resistance or you're working through red tape, but it's not always that simple. In industries like insurance, the stakes are really high and the systems that you're working within often exist for a reason. So change doesn't just happen, it has to happen very carefully. And this creates a serious challenge for founders, especially when so many tech founders are coming in with the Silicon Valley mindset, which is move fast and disrupt. In environments like this, when you move too fast or you propose change without seriously considering process or you don't build deep trust with key stakeholders, you will kill your deal long before it comes to fruition. The guest that I have here with me today has spent the last 7 years navigating this exact tension. David McFarland is the founder and CEO of Coterie Insurance, which is a company that he started by working within the industry to make it better instead of trying to work around its limitation, and that nuance really matters. 7 years in, this approach has scaled to over $200 million in premium, more than 100,000 small business policies, and a recent investment from one of the largest insurance companies in the world. We are going to dig into what it means to create change at the speed of trust today. Thank you so much for being here, for making the trip. I appreciate it. Wait, how far is Appleton?
That's about an hour and a half. Oh, it's not too far.
Yeah, that's not bad, especially given the amount of travel that you do.
Yes.
This is like a short trip for you.
It is.
It seems.
Short day trip.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I appreciate that. Yeah. So let's get the lay of the land, I guess, before we go deeper. Give me a quick overview of, I guess, your background and the company that you're building.
Yeah. So I am a actuary. If you know what they are, they have large collections of calculators, usually stare at their shoes, but...
Good start.
Okay. Yeah, I'm really making friends with the actuarial group. But we quantify risk, really quantify the transfer of risk. So basically insurance companies are going to say, you have a risk that we want and you'll pay us to take it, right?
Yeah.
And an actuary is the one who quantifies what does that payment need to be? How much does an insurance company need to charge to take the risk off of Jackie, right? And that's kind of how I got started in the insurance world. I guess most people kind of find their way into insurance in some weird meandering way. I'm somewhat similar. It was just more in college that happened.
Yeah.
And then through all that, I saw a great opportunity in this like small micro commercial space. Or basically no one wanted to deal with it because it would take 4 hours to actually quote and bind policy and the agents would make $200. And that just doesn't make sense. So I thought, you know, we could probably solve this problem using data and technology and make it easier and better for everybody. And so that's really what we're doing at Coterie, just making it stupidly easy for agents to bind the small commercial policy and really help the insured to get on with their life. Because frankly, most small business owners don't care about insurance.
Yeah. It's like a something that you know you need.
Oh, yeah.
But it's not necessarily like, I'm going to go get insurance.
That's it. And we recognize that. Just yeah. we don't pretend that insurance needs to be a valuable part of your life, except when it comes to actually paying the claims.
Yeah. Most people that I've met that work in insurance, which, I mean, I've spent a lot of my career in insurance, too. Yeah. It's not, they don't go to college usually for like... okay, I'm going to go work in insurance. You said the meandering way of getting it. Have you found that to be true as well?
Oh, yeah. For pretty much, I'll say nearly everyone in insurance, the only exception is typically actuaries.
Okay.
Actuaries usually find out that there's a way to make money doing math, and they find that out in college, and that's when they say, I'm going to go into the insurance space.
That makes a lot of math people.
Yeah.
I'm married to a CFO, also a math person, so I get that. I get that.
Riveting one. Conversations, yeah. I'm sure.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. He's more personable than most, I will say.
It's good.
Otherwise, probably wouldn't have married him, but, you know, that's a different podcast.
Yeah.
So I have a quote from you. You've said, I've been working in insurance for a long time, and I think it would be fair to say that technological innovation is not the industry's strong suit. I have also been working in insurance tech for a long time, mm-hmm. and I would agree with that. Specifically, what did you see inside of the industry that made you think that you should start your company there?
The most obvious thing was the problem, right? Basically, the need for small commercial insurance, this massively underpenetrated market, and why it was underpenetrated, right? The agents didn't want to deal with it because the speed at which they could bind a policy was 4 to 8 hours. They're not going to make money. The insurance companies couldn't handle it from an expense ratio standpoint. And everything was just very touch-based, manual. And there's reasons for that. I'd say there's two reasons to get to your technology one. One is just an incentivization problem. Underwriters are incentivized in some respect to keep things going the way that they've always done it, right? Mm-hmm. They're not going to mess up from a loss ratio standpoint. Everything's just going to be good if they can put their hands on it, hopefully. And they don't want to lose their jobs, right?
Right.
The other side of it is the data problem and the technology problem, which is what we're really talking about. Insurance companies have been around for a long time. They've set up on these systems that are fairly antiquated, and it's tough to attract the best technological minds to work on a bunch of systems that were around 20, 30 plus years ago.
Yeah. Right?
And so what you have is you have new companies that have great technology where all the systems can talk to each other and you can automate these flows. And then you have insurance, which has one, a lack of technology in that respect, and two, a group of people who are largely disincentivized to change anything. And so in those cases, it's doubly difficult to attract innovative technological thinkers to make changes in those legacy players. So I thought, hey, you know, it'd be great if we could actually do this inside an insurance company. But after being in the insurance space a little while, I was realizing this may not be the best place to do it, and thus started Coterie.
Yeah. Okay. So starting an insurance company is definitely a capital intensive endeavor. And I read a little bit about how you self-funded in the early days and the story behind that. Do you want to tell us a little bit about how that happened?
Yeah, but I definitely don't want to make myself sound better than I am. I self-funded out of necessity.
Yes. That is kind of what I'm tiptoeing into if you do want to tell that story. Yeah.
So when early days, I was starting Coterie, and before we had anyone on the team, anything like that, we had some people who were potentially interested in investing. And they loved the idea, loved the background. We had potential partners that we were talking to. And I was actually, already set to move to Cincinnati, leave Chicago and start on this journey of doing the whole Coterie thing. And I was at a going away party with my wife, and we had two kids at the time, and we were pregnant with our third trimester, because why not? And
you know, Perfect time for a change.
Yeah, exactly. And we were leaving the next week. So it was a Saturday. We were hanging out with our friends, saying goodbye, all that kind of fun stuff. And I get a call while at this party on a Saturday. And it's one of these investors. So I pick up and he's like, "Hey, David, you know, just wanted to talk to you about the company. And we love the idea, love your background, all that kind of stuff. But we really want you to start a digital agency. Not an actual insurance company that creates the products. There's a lot of risk there, and we think it's more prudent to go this other direction." And don't get me wrong, I think digital agencies are great. We work through digital agencies, but the goal was to create something such that the digital agencies and all of our other partners could actually address this big problem.
Yeah.
And just starting another digital agency wasn't going to do that. So I explained that. And told him, it wasn't aligned with my vision. He said, "Okay, well, we're out." And
it's like Shark Tank. Yeah. And so I'm out.
Yeah. So I was like, okay. Hung up the phone and went back to the party. Did not tell my wife until after we left the party. Probably, didn't want to spoil things immediately. But needless to say, was maybe a little distracted. But even so, we drove home, talked about it, and still left. And went to Cincinnati, recruited a team who I could not pay, and we worked for months together to try and make this work. And then on August 20th, we really got our first official term sheet. Yes.
Like harder, I assume, than doing it with yourself.
Yes. Yeah.
Seems it was. A no-brainer. Yeah.
Yeah. Definitely.
So you said earlier you started as an actuary. I would get, so my view on risk is kind of I'm a creative, right? Mm-hmm. I'm like, all right, I'm going to weigh out what the worst case scenarios are. And if I can deal with what I think the worst case scenario is, I think I'm going to be fine.
Yep.
I don't know that my husband exactly looks at it that way. I think he probably weighs risk a little bit differently than I. And I would guess that you as an actuary, where your training is evaluating risk, that probably makes you look at it a different way too. How does that shape your perspective as a founder?
I'd say that how I look at risk is probably pretty similar to how you look at it.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
In that you're basically looking at the various outcomes and ascribing a weight to it, right? And that's basically what actuaries do. We look at a variety of outcomes and we say, what's the probability of each outcome? And then we can, from that kind of figure out how much is this risk going to quote unquote cost? What's the overall risk associated with this? So you start a business, right? There's a 5% chance it goes really, really well, 20% chance that it goes decently. And then, let's say a 50% chance that it's going to be and then a 30% chance that it just completely flops, right? So weighting all that out, I'm not going to do the math right now, but that's some X percent chance of success. And so you go, okay. And but not just associated with the business, but what about me personally? Because it's not just about the business that succeeds. It's really about Jackie. It's about David. It's about our families, right? Mm-hmm. So can our families actually recover from these things? What is the worst case scenario in the event that the business does flop? And that's a thing that I think helps me as an actuary. It's not just what's the probability the business flops, that 30% number, right? It's, okay, well, in that scenario of the business flopping, what are the other scenarios associated with that, right? Well, I go get a job at another insurance company. Is that going to be a better job? Are they going to potentially give me more money because I've had all of this experience? Or am I going to, burn all my bridges in the insurance space and have to work at a grocery store the rest of my life? Who knows, right? But we can look at each one of these things and say, what does this mean in these particular scenarios? And take that same probability weighting, but just apply it in a more, tree-based approach, right? So this produces these results and all these other things. Mm-hmm. So that's how I look at it.
Okay. I think you're definitely a little more methodical than me. So maybe similar concept, but I'm kind of okay. I could survive going bankrupt probably. Yeah. I could get a job. I'm hireable. Okay, I'm going to do this.
Exactly. That's it.
Same but different.
Yeah. The problem is, I think that oftentimes entrepreneurs can fall into the realm of just there's only 100% chance that this is going to work. And that's delusional.
Yes.
Yeah.
And your likelihood of failure was probably pretty high, right?
Yeah.
And going through, you know, everything that you did, you probably had to have just a little bit of delusional optimism.
I don't disagree.
Okay.
I look at things slightly different. Maybe it is delusional optimism. maybe it's narcissism. I don't know. But so as an actuary, we have to take exams in order to become what's called either an associate or a fellow. So I'm a fellow in the Casualty Actuarial Society. I passed all the exams. And these exams have a pass rate on average of like 40%, 50%, right? So they're failing 50 to 60% every time. And they set it such that they want to fail that many people.
Yeah.
So chances are when you step into that exam, you're going to fail, especially your first time taking it.
Sure.
Most people do not make it all the way through. It's very rare to do that. And I think training yourself throughout your life to do certain things like that, I don't mean to compare like professional athletes to actuaries. We're very different.
But I'm going to.
Yeah, but I'm going to. But like the probability of becoming a professional athlete is extremely low.
Mm-hmm.
And who are these crazy people who think like, I'm going to become a professional athlete? Well, yes, it's a bit of delusional optimism, but it's also just every scenario you encounter, you're just like, no, I'm going to push my hardest. I'm going to do my best. And if I fail, I'm only failing for a short time and I'm going to continue to win regardless.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, that's probably a little crazy and a little delusional, but I'm also wondering if just like that is maybe delusional optimism isn't delusional. Maybe that delusional optimism is actually people who have a better understanding of what's going on and just pushing through. Like tenacity is really the benefit. Tenacity makes winners because we're all going to fail. We're all going to lose. It's just who's going to continue through those gates, even when you're on your face and you've lost and you, it doesn't matter. You're just like, nope, I'm gonna get up the next day and go. And I feel like that's, and then you hold on and then you get out of it. And now it's like, oh, it's great. EBITDA positive, cash flow positive, you know, great growth. And it's fun.
And then it resulted in your recent raise, right? Which, when did you close your Series C?
We closed on that in September or October of 2025.
Okay.
Yeah, with Allianz. That was kind of the end of that story, right?
Yeah.
Where thankfully, and so 2024, late 2024 was our first cash flow positive month, EBITDA positive month. And then 2025, full cash flow positive, full EBITDA positive, and people actually saw that the model worked.
Yep.
And that was interesting getting there because, you know, we basically said we're going to build this fixed cost insurance business where we could write these small risks that no one else had really been able to write profitably. And no one really believes you when you're, you know, just building it out. But you have to do that in order to get the fixed cost business.
Yep.
And so in 2025, the model was very clear. And we had a great relationship with Allianz on the reinsurance side. We made that more of an official partnership via this equity deal. And it was fantastic. I couldn't be more thankful for the partnership with them.
Yeah, congratulations. Yeah. That is really incredible. All right, y'all, it's shameless plug time. I want to take a quick break to chat with you about Excelity, my full service marketing agency. For the last 12 years, we've been working closely with B2B software and service companies. Now we are expanding and looking for growth stage companies with a bold vision, but maybe lacking the marketing strategy or resources to get there. Or hey, you might have resources that just aren't working out. We definitely see that all the time. At Excelity, our team gets results and we have a ton of fun doing it.
I'm sure you can tell that from listening to this podcast. So if you or someone you know is a fit, check us out at excelitymarketing.com or reach out to me directly on LinkedIn.
What do you think that you did right during that raise? And what would you say is the biggest thing that you learned through that process?
That raise is a terrible example. That one's one of those like fairy tale raises where like, yeah. You know, you meet with a partner who you've been working with and it's like, oh, hey, we really work together well. How can we make this a real thing? Yeah, exactly. Okay. Like, okay.
Well, we could expand through your fundraising process if you want to.
Yeah. Let's look at all the bad ones.
okay.
And you know, we have a pretty, like, if you look at the metrics and the raise history, it's kind of one of those, you know, fairy tale looking stories where it's like, oh, well, series A of this and B of this and C of this. And wow, that's so great. And the continued growth rate. And that's not real life. That's not what happens, right? Mm-hmm. There's troubles, there's difficulties, there's employment issues, there's investment issues, there's all kinds of stuff throughout the whole thing. So I like to tell people I have about probably less than 1% success rate when it comes to raising money. Each time I go out to raise, I talk to at least 100 investors.
Hmm.
And especially during the hard times, every one of them would say no,
okay.
Except maybe one. And that's probably because I'm bad at pitching. I tend to be probably more honest and transparent about the business. But thankfully, I think that's led to a group of investors who I really like. And we get along. I feel like I have the best board and some of the best investors in the business. I mean that broadly, fintech or other venture-backed capital firms in general. And so I would encourage people to, again, have that tenacious spirit. Call it delusional optimism, whatever you want to call it. But just don't be disheartened when the first 20 people you talk to say no. Now, learn from it. Don't be disheartened, but also learn from feedback. There may be things that are problematic with your model. And if there are, fix them, right? But continue pushing through. Talk to people and find good investors. If you're just focused on valuation and like, oh, how can I maximize valuation? Then you're focusing on kind of a vanity metric. We've always focused on the quality of the investors and the terms associated with it, with valuation being probably one of the least important things.
Yeah.
Right. You can get a great valuation, but if you have certain liquidation preferences or something like that, you're going to be destroyed as a
and for your brain and your experience and connections too. Like if you have connections to those people that can help us solve those problems, all the better. So yeah. I want to dig in a little bit more to what we were just talking about in the industry, especially I think there is a lot of nuance in this industry where decisions can be slow. They can go through committee. They can take months, right? Buying decisions can really be scrutinized, right? Yeah. And new ideas can kind of be picked apart sometimes. And implementations can take a really long time too. How do you build a company that can innovate and can move fast when by nature, sometimes your customers maybe work against that a little bit?
The one way, I'll say fundamentally, the thing that we had to do from the beginning is be in control of the insurance product. And that was the only way this was going to work. So there were a few other insurtech startups who started around the same time as us, and or even before us. And they had similar ideas of addressing small micro commercial, but they relied on hooking into other carriers, letting those carriers control the insurance product. And they essentially just empowered a good distribution of it. And they had great technology, they're good companies, but it led to the problem that you just mentioned. If the insurance company says, well, you know, we're going in a different strategic direction because the committee said so, so we're, you know, divesting from this, well, you're left without anything.
Mm-hmm.
And further, if you say, hey, we've got this opportunity with this particular segment, well, you're beholden to them. we control the insurance product. We do everything associated with it, with the rate filings, the claims, the servicing, all of it. And because of that, we can move much more nimbly than some of the other partners and some of the other carriers out there. But that only works if you get the first part right. And the second part they have to get right is the actual running of the company. If you run a company just like a legacy insurance company may run it, you're going to have the exact same problems, right? It's like, great, we own the insurance product, but we're just as slow as everybody else.
Yeah.
And a lot of that happens because it takes intellectual courage to make changes and to advocate for changes. Mm-hmm. It's much easier to get 14 people in a room together and collectively decide that this is the direction that we generally want to go. But we all know what that does, right? This distributed culpability, accountability, doesn't really produce real change. And so sometimes you have to switch that model and you have to say, look, here's what we're doing. We're going to go this way. And one person has to be the advocate. One person has to be the decision maker. And that's uncomfortable in, honestly, largely, I have no issue with democracy, but you know, we tend to put the benefits of a democratic society on a society, and then we want to incorporate it inside of a business. That can be difficult to do if you want to move fast. Mm-hmm. If you want to just keep everything from going any particular direction and just move in this slow, methodical progression forward at a couple of percentage points a year, great. But if you want to actually do something that's pretty quick and nimble, well, you need individual accountability.
Yes. How do you ensure that there is individual accountability across what I have to assume is a pretty big team at this point?
Yeah, we're about 170, 180 people.
Yeah.
It starts at really just like the leadership level. And what I mean by that is you can go in a dictatorial way where all decisions just come through David, right? And I don't have time for that. And there are much better people who can make decisions on the tech side, who can make decisions even on the insurance side. My background's in insurance, but we have some top-notch insurance people who even know our own product better than I do. Same thing on the growth side, on the finance side. And so empowering those people, my CFO, my CRO, my CUO, with the ability to actually make those decisions and know that I have their back. And even if it goes wrong, that we've talked about it and they're like, hey, this was a well thought out decision. This is something that we both collaborated on. If there's some stuff where like you completely neglected to think about logically, that's when I'm going to call you to account. But if something happens where like a mistake's made, well, you know what? My partner just got better because of that. They've learned something now that they may not have known before. Mm-hmm. There's exceptions to that, of course. But then what that does, by me empowering them to make these decisions and not Monday morning quarterbacking all the time, they empower their people to make the decisions. And you have to hire on it. That aspect of humility is critical. You can't have people who are just all about themselves, because then you delegate to them and just stops there. Everything then goes up to them and they're actually a burden on the organization instead of helping to move fast. And so essentially that delegation, I don't know, call it waterfall, but you know, where people are humble enough to recognize there are people on their team even more equipped to make these decisions and to bring things to fruition, that helps immensely.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That makes a lot of sense. And I think when you're going through, I mean, it starts with leadership, and it's also like there is so much accountability. Yep. Through like management, through individual layers. And I think everyone kind of has to help hold each other accountable too.
Yes.
And you have to have your own level of accountability to a job, to a company, to like an outcome. Yep. And it's fun to see when everyone is just bought in on like a mission, a culture, what you're doing. Yep. So much so that they are like willing to hold themselves accountable to it.
Yes.
And it seems like that is really something that you're ingraining in the culture.
It's my favorite part of the team. We've got a strong culture of similar people who are just like, we're like competitive, nerdy athletes. Right? and you know, not all about ourselves. So it's a good team. There's always areas for improvement. We should always be looking at ourselves and like, hey, you know, David, you missed this, you do this, but it's a really great team.
Good. I love that. Okay. A couple questions left. So I want to get personal for a second.
Yep.
I think when you look at the whole picture of what you've built a VC-backed company. It's grown from $6 to $80 million in revenue over the last few years, which is crazy. And you've done it in the Midwest, not on one of the coasts. And you are married, you've stayed married through all of this, which the staying part can sometimes be rare through this process. You have 6 kids, you homeschool them. And I will tell you, I think just, I talked to so many founders through my agency, we're 300 some episodes into this podcast, and half of those have been talking to different founders. Most of them feel like they can't do all of that stuff at the same time. And they feel like there are sacrifices that you have to make. Mm-hmm. There are, if you're growing a high growth company, then you have to sacrifice the family, or you have to sacrifice the kids, or you have to focus over here, so you can't do this. How do you, I guess, do all of it? And I think this is a question that I think women get all the time. Like, how do you balance it all? How did you build the company in a way that didn't require the trading of the rest of it?
Well, it probably did.
Okay.
Don't get me wrong. I'm not going to pretend that like I have some 15-hour work week.
Yeah.
But I'll say first and foremost, my wife gets like almost all the credit.
Yeah.
she's top notch. I would not be able to do any of this without her. I mean, obviously, 6 kids, right? Yeah. you can't do that.
Yeah.
She takes on a lot, and it's tough on her because many times I do have to, you know, prioritize the job, and you know, you see a lot of stuff that probably feels good when you read it, like, hey, you know, real freedom is not having an alarm and waking up whenever you want, and other.
Okay.
And I'm like, maybe I like responsibility, and I've got 6 alarms running around my house. Mm-hmm. And I've got work, right? But yeah, you know, so I'm not going to provide any type of, you know, secret sauce that people can apply and they can have a full life full of all kinds of other stuff. Okay, so let me just make that clear. Now I'm going to go on to like general application. Most people look at my life and they, in their head, maybe, I don't want to say that, but maybe they're thinking, wow, this is a crazy amount, right? 6 kids, homeschooling, running a business, all that kind of stuff. But if I just focus on the kids side, one thing I tell people a lot is that the easiest number of kids is N minus 1. And you have 3 kids.
Mm-hmm.
When you had your first, you thought no kids. Man, I wish I could just go back to no kids. It was so easy back then. Then you have 2. And then your spouse takes one and you only have 1. You're like, 1 is so easy. It's like magic. Mm-hmm. Then you have 3. And then spouse takes the other one and you have only 2. You're just like, oh, no problem. Same with 6, honestly. You have 6. You're left with 5, you're like, oh, this is not too bad. Mm-hmm. And while we can apply that to the kid principle, we can do that with pretty much everything, right? It's not like I started Coterie and had 6 kids with 180 employees. Until it doesn't, you get an aneurysm and drop dead. But
and that's the end of the podcast. Thanks. Perfect. So. Yeah, love it. Okay, one last question.
Yeah.
We talked about lots of topics today. If you have one piece of advice, parting words for our listeners today, anyone who's trying to grow a business, maybe emulate some of what you've done, what is it?
I'd say do things that are first order negative, second order positive. And this is everything. Having kids is first order negative, second order positive.
Truly.
It's really hard in the beginning. But, you know, then you start seeing them become, you know, real productive members of society. And a lot of that, a lot of the discipline, the love, when you definitely don't want to love them because they're kind of annoying, all of that is that first order negative that you have to put in order to reap the benefits long term. And running a business is the same way. Talking to your board about the bad things associated with your business is first order negative. But how else are you going to get the best advice in the room, right? Saving for retirement so you don't have to eat cat food when you're 75 years old, right? Working out now so that you can actually, you know, go on long walks with your great grandkids, right? All of these things, put in the hard work now so that you can benefit over the long term. And it can be really hard to do that. Firing that toxic employee. And we've all done things where we're like, you know, I'm just gonna sweep this under the rug.
Let it ride.
Yeah.
See what happens.
Yep.
And the whatever happens as a result of that is always worse than if you would have taken the action that you should have in the first place.
100%. How many times have we seen this occur in a variety of areas in our lives?
Mm-hmm.
And so just doing that first order negative, second order positive, and making that a part of your life and recognizing the circumstances where it really, really, really matters is critical. And I was told that advice a long time ago, and I think that's probably one of the most valuable pieces of advice I've gotten.
I've never heard it phrased that way, and I think that is a perfect way to end today. Thank you so much for being here. For everyone that is listening, if you learned something today, please pass this on to just one person that needs to hear this message, and I will talk to you next time. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Jackie.